Recording. You'll probably need to okay that at your end. We're going to put everybody on a temporary mute, but feel free to unmute, chime in, participate, and as you wish. And last thing I need to do is share my screen. Okay, we're good. Can everybody see my see the text? That's the source page. I sent it out this morning by email in case you wanted it. Otherwise, it'll be here on the screen for us. And we are jumping into where we left off last week, which was a question. So let's just put ourselves back into the context of the question. The last piece of, so the whole perek is a Yud Gimel. It deals with essentially two major themes, right? So we dealt with the events of Amnon and Tamar, and then Avshalom's revenge by killing Amnon, waiting 2 years, and then he has this opportunity, he takes Avshalom, he takes Amnon out into his hometown, and he has him killed. You see it in Pasuk Chavtet, Ve'asu Nare Avshalom L'Amnon Kasher Tziva Avshalom. And he does exactly the Na'arim, the servants of Avshalom, do as they were commanded, and they kill Amnon. And all of the Bnei HaMelech, who now don't know what's going on, they think that Avshalom is vying for the throne. They think he's launching an all-out rebellion, although they're a chapter too soon, but nonetheless, that's their perception. And so they run, they flee. And then the Shemur comes back to the king that, in fact, Avshalom has killed all the Bnei HaMelech. And they cry and they tear their clothes and they sit on the floor and they're literally mourning for the entire elimination of the royal family. Until Vayan Yonadab ben Shima, Achid David, Vayomar, Al Yomar Adoni, et Kolanarim ben Amalach, Hamidu, Ki Amnon Levado Med. No, my master, don't think that he killed everybody. He only killed Amnon. And Avshalom had been planning this. Ki Alpia Avshalom, Etasumam, Yom Anato, Tamachoto. Don't think for a moment that all of the Bnei Amalach have been killed. Al Yasim Adoni Amalach Alibo. This is just a rumor. Rather, it's only Amnon, Ki Amnon Levado Med. Yonadav understands Avshalom's motive and he understands what transpired. Our focus today is on these two words, but we're going to kind of see them in context. Vayivach Avshalom, Avshalom ran away. Vayisa na hatsofet eina vayar inei am rav hochim miderach acharav mitzad ha'har. The outlook, the watchman looks out to the tower and he sees a group of people coming back from the mountain. We're back to the story of the Bnei HaMelech. Yonadav says to the king, you see, I was right. Bnei HaMelech, they're fine. They're all coming home. As I told you. The Bnei HaMelech come. They lift up their voices. They cry. Now they know, now they can understand what happened, right? Now the whole story comes out. Avshalom has killed Amnon, and the heir to the throne, the crown prince, the Gam HaMelech, v'chol avadav b'chu b'chi gadol ma'od, they're all crying. And Avshalom, in the meantime, Avshalom barach, he ran away. Elech al Tamai ben Amihud, Melech Geshur, he ran to the king of Geshur. V'itabel al b'no kol hayamim. And he mourned for his son all of his days. Again, the ambiguity in the pronouns here is important for us, but it's pretty self-evident that this Vayit Abel, he mourned, cannot be referring to the same Avshalom, who is the subject of the beginning of the verse, but rather Vayit Abel is going back to David. David mourned for his son Amnon all of his days. Avshalom barach, in the meantime Avshalom ran away, v'ayelach Geshur v'isham shalosh shanim, and he remained in Geshur for 3 years. V'tachal David ha'melech latzet el Avshalom, David longed for Avshalom, yearned for him, pined for him, ki nicham al Amnon kimet, he was eventually comforted for the death of Amnon, and his focus turns to Avshalom. And that essentially is the beginning or the segue into Perek Yudalid. Vayeda Yoav ben Tzruya ki lev hamelech alav shalom. Yoav understood that David has finally reached a point where he's ready to see Avshalom come back. That's the Perek, or the end of the Perek. And where we left off last week was with this question of the reference to Avshalom's flight. And there were three major issues with the reference to Avshalom fleeing this scene. First is a chronological one. At what point does Avshalom run away to Geshur? If I looked at the sequence of events chronologically and assumed that everything happens literally in the chronological sequence in which it is written, it would seem that Avshalom runs away after the Bnei HaMelech come back to Yerushalayim. That makes no sense whatsoever. So it's clear that Avshalom had run away from a chronological perspective. When did Avshalom run? He fled when the Bnei HaMelech fled, meaning the Bnei HaMelech fled in one direction, and Avshalom, who had just killed his brother, who had just killed the crown prince, who just committed treason, understood the consequences of his actions, he fled in a different direction, and he fled out of the country to seek asylum by his grandfather, the king of the land of Geshur. If that's the case, then Vayivrach Avshalom, the fact that Avshalom ran away, really belongs after Pasuk Chavtet. Vayasu Narei Avshalom L'Amnon Kasher Tzivah Avshalom. The Na'arim did as they were instructed, killed Amnon. Bnei HaMelech fled. Vayivrach Avshalom, and Avshalom fled. And everybody just ran in different directions. Why leave that piece of information out there and delay it five psukim to the beginning of Pasuk Lamed Daled? That's mystery number one. You could say, if that was the only question, that its placement is specifically related to its placement is based on a principle of Tanakh will finish one subject before moving on to another. In other words, the subject here is the murder of Amnon, that and the flight of the Bnei HaMelech and the concern about the Bnei HaMelech. So we'll finish that story and then turn our attention to the fact that Avshalom ran away. That's a separate part of the story. The problem is that we're not finished with the Bnei HaMelech. This Vayivrach Avshalom is inserted into the middle of the story of the Bnei HaMelech. Here is Yonadav speaking to the king saying, Bnei HaMelech are not dead, they're all fine, they're all going to come home eventually. Here is the Tzofeh saying to the king, I see them coming down the hill. And in the middle, I'm told by Yivach Avshalom. So if you're going to move it somewhere logical. That's question number one. Question number two is the fact that the reference to Avshalom's flight appears in the text three different places. Here it says, Vayivrach Avshalom. Then in Pasuk Lamed Zayin, it says again, Avshalom Barach, Avshalom ran away. And he ran to Tamai Melech Kishur. And then in Pasuk Lamed Chet, Avshalom Barach, Avshalom had run away. And he went to Geshur and he stayed there for 3 years. So I have three separate psukim to tell me the same information, that Avshalom ran away. And in fact, this the Mephoshim already pick up, that there's a redundancy in the text. There's a kind of a slow release of information. If you look at the Metzudat David points out, Avshalom Barach, meaning first it tells us that he fled, Shabarach Mimkomo. Then it tells us Shalach al Tamai that he went to the king of Geshur. And now at the last pasuk, Lamed Chet, it comes to tell me that he stayed there for 3 years. Shahasham Shalosh Shanim. I have three different pieces of information released at three different points in the story. Why not just summarize it all in one? In fact, I'm going to do something a little dangerous. I'm going to make up a pasuk. Okay, I'm going to invent a verse that's not here. And here's the verse I'm going to invent. And I promise you this text, this pasuk does not appear in the perek. I've listed it on the source page as Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Gimel. There is no pasuk. It does not exist. I made this up. What does it say? Vayivrach Avshalom, vayelach el Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur, vayisham shalosh shanim. Avshalom ran away. He ran to Tamai, the king of Geshur, his grandfather, and he stayed there for 3 years. Anything wrong with this pasuk? Perfectly articulates exactly all of the pieces of information that we are told in this parak, concisely and directly. It's exactly the composition of these three phrases, Vayivrach Avshalom, Avshalom barach vayelech al Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur, Avshalom barach vayelech Geshur vayisham shalosh shanim. It's exactly what I put here. Vayivrach Avshalom vayelech al Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur vayisham shalosh shanim. Only difference is this pasuk doesn't exist. Instead, I've divided the information into three separate places, which in itself is a problem.
Maybe they want to emphasize that Shalom Absalom fled, and they want to emphasize where he went, and they want to emphasize where he was for 3 years.
You are correct, I think, except I'm missing one piece of the story, which is not only does the facts of his flight get divided into three separate phrases, the placement of each of these phrases is in the wrong location. Meaning each one of these phrases seems to interrupt the flow of a non sequitur. So Joyce, you're correct. And we're going to come back to what you're suggesting, which is that each one emphasizes a different point. But the question that we have to answer in that context is why in these locations, specific places, why in Pasuk Lamed Dalet, Lamed Zayin, and Lamed Chet, what's going on? Because if you look at the text, it would seem to interrupt a flow that is irrelevant. For example, start from Pasuk Lamed Aleph, and we're going to read from Lamed Aleph or Lamed Bet to Lamed Hey. I'm going to do something a little bit dangerous. I'm going to, besides reducing the size of the font of the text, I'm going to ignore that phrase. I'm going to read it as if that phrase doesn't exist. Yaakov and Melech, they're all sitting on the floor, they're all crying, they're all tearing their garments, they think that the whole kingdom has died. Vayan Yonadav ben Shima, Achid David, Yonadav says to David, "No, my king, no, my master, the Bnei Melech have not died, the Bnei Melech are fine, Amnon alone has died, Avshalom has been plotting this for 2 years since the day that Amnon raped his sister. Don't pay any attention to the rumors that Avshalom killed all of the Melech. Ki Amnon levadomet, only Amnon has died. In the meantime, the watchman looks up and he sees people coming on their mules coming down from the mountain. And Yonadav pipes up and he says, "Ha, you see, my king, I'm right. The king's people, the children are coming home. As I told you, this was exactly right. I predicted it." In other words, the subject of this whole section is what? The subject is the report, the rumor that all the Bnei Melech have been killed, and the suggestion by Yonadav that that is in fact not the case, that only Amnon has died, the verification of the facts, and then the Tzofeh who sees that in fact Yonadav is correct and the Bnei Melech come home. So Yonadav's assertion and the Tzofeh's confirmation of that assertion. That's the subject. In the middle of all of that, Vayivrach Avshalom is inserted. It kind of just disrupts the flow. I skipped it. Nothing bothered us in the text. Okay. Now let's try the next one. Next verse. Vayi kechalotol daber v'nei b'nei ha-melech ba'o. They're speaking, and in the meantime, we're going to skip this. That's the piece we're going to skip now, okay? So we're reading Lamed Vav and Lamed Zayin. We're going to skip the part that I highlighted. As they're speaking, the Bnei Melech came back, and now the whole story unfolds that Avshalom killed Amnon, and Amnon is was the crown prince, heir to the throne, has died. Vayisu kolam, they cried, vayivku, v'gam ha-melech v'chol avdav b'chu, the king cried and the people cried, v'chi gadol me'od. Who are they crying about? Right? They're not crying Nebuch because Avshalom committed murder, right? They're crying because of the death of Amnon. Vayit abel David al b'no kol hayamim. And David mourned his son all the days of his life. We're talking about Amnon. Mefarshim all unanimously interpret this phrase, Vayit abel al b'no, that he mourned for his son, is referring to Amnon. Right, David is mourning for Amnon. So why is the flight of Avshalom relevant to that moment in time? Then, Pasuk Lamed Chet, I'm going to replace this Pasuk. I know I'm doing dangerous things tonight. I'm in the mood. I'm going to replace this Pasuk. Avshalom barach ve'elach gishu v'hisham shalosh shanim. I'm going to replace that Pasuk with the invented Pasuk I put here. Vayivrach Avshalom, because I skipped it the other two times. So Vayivrach Avshalom, me'elach al Tamai ben Amihud melach gishur. Avshalom ran away to Tamai melach gishur. And he remained there for 3 years. And then David Shalom. Okay, so now David has become a little more comforted for Amnon, and he begins to pine for Avshalom. So if I took the two phrases, Pasuk Lamed Dalet and Pasuk Lamed Zayin, out of the text, and I just left Pasuk Lamed Chet, the text would be fine. Now, I'm not going to do that. And there are many schools of scholarship in Tanakh that did exactly what I just did. They cut and pasted out the phrases that don't belong in the proper place, in their place, and they put them in the end. Right? That's not what I'm suggesting. I am suggesting that we look at the text and we see the problem. It's not just the fact that Avshalom's flight is in the wrong location. It's divided up into three separate phrases, and each phrase seems to be in a place where it doesn't belong. So the table is set for us to kind of put all the pieces of the puzzle together by suggesting an answer to all three of these questions, which is more along the lines of what Joyce suggested earlier, which is that somehow the emphasis of each of these pieces of information needs to fit the context in which it appears. So to understand this, yeah, there was a question.
I was going to say, maybe it's trying to show chaos a little bit.
If I didn't have a more direct connection between each phrase and its context, other than nobody knows what's going on, I could answer that. But I think there's something more direct. I think that there's a specific reference in each instance to why that phrase is where it is. So that's what we need to work through. And I'm actually going to start with a little bit of background. I think it's important to understand the role that the Torah and Tanakh as a whole attributes to the crime of murder in general and fratricide in particular. Because what we're dealing with is brother kills brother. Let me just stop sharing for a second, kind of just to focus our attention. What we're dealing here with is brother kills brother. So if we think about the moral crimes that the Torah, Tanakh as a whole, addresses, there are many moral crimes that Tanakh addresses, but none are as big as murder. And none are as big as murder in the context of fratricide, brother killing brother. All of Tanakh, all of Chumash starts with essentially two stories. One is Ben Adam L'Malkom, is the story of Gan Eden, and the other is Cain kills Hevel. First murder in history is fratricide. Then the rest of Sefer Breshit unfolds, and you have the concern. Rivka says to Yaakov that he needs to run away. Why? Because Esav said, Esav b'libo, Esav had said in his heart that as soon as my father dies, aharga et Yaakov achi, I will kill my brother Yaakov. And so Rivka sends him away. We'll come back to that phrase in a few moments. But from there, you have the story of Yosef and his brothers. And what's the biggest concern there, right? Yosef, who, with his dreams and his delusions of grandeur and everything else that's going on at the beginning of the story, this week's parasha. They see Yosef showing up from a distance. Vayarato mirachok. Vayitnaklu oto lahamito. They wanted to kill him. They were plotting to kill Yosef. So if you look at Sefer Bereishit, not only does it deal with the crimes of murder, but it deals with it from the perspective of the archetype, which is a fratricide. Then we have, now those two cases, it didn't happen because Yosef's life was saved and Yaakov's life was saved, but you have other instances. We saw the story of Avimelech. We saw it last week where Avimelech kills all of his brothers because he wants the throne. There's another similar story we saw at Tayyar, where there's another similar story of Yehoram ben Yoshaphat who kills his brothers to take the throne of Yehuda. So the notion of fratricide as a crime is not just an act of murder, but one that has a unique status in Halach, a unique status in the history of Tanakh. So we're dealing with a very powerful piece or a moment that needs to be understood in that context. Now I'll go back to sharing. I'll show you two things in the Rambam. The Rambam, in addressing the question of the severity of the crimes, that are moral crimes that a person can commit, writes the following, and this is in the laws of murder, Hilchot Vatzeach, Af al pi sheyesh avonot chamurim, mishfuchut damim, there might be transgressions even more serious than murder. But from the perspective of the Torah, ein behem hashchatat yishuvo shel olam kishfichut damim. Nothing presents as serious a danger to society as does murder. Afilu avodah zarah, even idolatry, and certainly other crimes such as incest and chilul Shabbat and other crimes, einan kishfichut damim. They don't have the stigma and the intensity and the severity of murder. Murder destroys the integrity of a society. Furthermore, he says, a person can commit murder is as if none of the totality of all of his other values that he's attained over the years equals or balances out this crime of murder. The example that he gives is Achav. Achav, we've encountered many times. Achav was an Oved Avodah Zarah, who certainly worshipped idols. Achav brings Yizevel into the kingdom. Achav was many crimes in terms of his, but on the other hand, he was a loyal servant of the people. He was a loyal king. He was a devoted king. And kishenizru avonatav uzchuyatav lifnei elokei haruchot lo nimtza avon shechivu kleyav lo haya shem davar acher sheshaku kenegdo. When Achav's balance scale was weighed, it was found that everything else, nothing could weigh Achav's judgment in the negative until the blood of Nevayot, which his wife killed because he wanted the vineyard. That was the seal. That was the final stage, the final seal on Achav's fate. And he didn't even do it. He just had it orchestrated through his wife. So we need to understand right from the outset that the notion of murder is given a particular severity and particular place in the context of how the Torah deals with it because of its status. So in the process of the judicial process of addressing a murderer or a murder against a victim, the Torah presents a very unique way of dealing with that judgment. Post-trial, person commits murder, he's put on trial, he's usually put on trial, he usually flees, runs to the city of refuge, the Ir Miklat. There's a trial. Assuming for a moment he's found innocent, he gets to stay in the Ir Miklat and is protected. If he's found guilty, what happens to him? Murder is a capital offense in the Torah. So what happens to the murderer? After he's found guilty, he's killed by the Beit Din, correct? Yes? Everybody agree to that? Sure?
The Beit Din didn't kill anybody.
Is that your final answer? Right? Because take a look what the pasuk says. Ve'im be'eben yada she'yamut be'ikao ve'yamot. If he kills somebody with a kli, with a vessel, with a utensil that is capable of killing, meaning this premeditation here, then vatzeachu, he is considered a vatzeach. Mot yumato vatzeach, and a vatzeach is to be put to death. Vatzeach is a capital crime. Whether it be one kind of kli or another kind of kli, whatever, the Torah is dealing with the question of the weapon. Vayamot vatzeach. He has to be put to death. Who executes the rotzeach? Says the Torah, Goel Hadam, who yamit et rotzeach. The murderer shall be put to death by the blood avenger, the Goel Hadam, the redeemer of the blood. What does that mean? That means that at least in an ideal scenario, at least the way the Torah presents it conceptually, after the criminal is found guilty, he is handed over to the Goel Adam, who is a relation, the closest relation to the victim, for justice. That's the Torah's way of kind of almost the eye for an eye kind of concept. And the Rambam records this in Hilchot Rotzeach, Mitzvah biyad goel hadam laharog et haratzeach. The mitzvah is incumbent upon the redeemer of the blood, the avenger, to kill the perpetrator of the murderer. As it says, goel hadam, hu yamit et haratzeach. Who qualifies as a goel hadam? It's not a free fall. It's not a haphazard free for all, whoever, you know, you kind of, okay, guys, just do with them what you want. Right? There was a structure. The closer the relation is in terms of the Yerusha, in terms of the inheritance of the victim, is considered the closer relation in terms of the Goel Adam. However, if Lo Ratze Goel Adam, if the Goel Adam doesn't want to take that judgment in his hands, or is incapable of doing so, or there is no redeemer, a person has no relations in that context, then the Beit Din steps in to execute the murderer, because murder is a capital offense. Okay. So the Torah's presentation from a halachic perspective is conceptual. Whether or not in fact it gets implemented is a question we can address, but the concept is very straightforward. Person A kills person B, he forfeits his life. Who does he forfeit his life to? He forfeits his life to the family members of the victim to exact judgment, justice. Now, you understand that that creates a certain dilemma. And the dilemma is highlighted in a situation where the Goel Adam doesn't want or cannot fulfill the responsibility or the role of the Goel Adam, or I'll phrase it differently, what happens if the Goel Adam finds himself in a position where exacting judgment against the murderer only continues to perpetuate the crime? And what do I mean by that? The classic example where the moral dilemma of this scenario is presented is brother kills brother. In a case of fratricide, Rotzeach Ach, as it's referred to in the halach, who's the Goel Adam? Who's the closest relation who's now given the responsibility to kill, to execute the murderer?
The murderer.
Is it the father?
The father? Another brother? Are we going to perpetuate the cycle within the family? You understand the problem? Yerushalmi
relative to both of them.
Right. The Yerushalmi has a very powerful discussion in Masechet Makot over exactly this question and two opinions. If you have a case where Ach Sheikat Achiv, one brother kills another brother, is the third brother considered a Goel Adam? One opinion says, Achiv Hasheni Nasa Goel Adam. The second, the third brother is now the Goel Adam. And the first, and another opinion says, no, Achiv Sheikat Achiv, Ein Achiv Hasheni Nasa Goel Adam. How can you set brother against brother? How can you perpetuate the moral degradation of a society by saying to brother, the third brother, okay, you're going to kill, like, just, do you understand the perpetuation of this within one family? Is extraordinary. So it's one thing when the dilemma is, you know, it's one thing when the murder is committed by an outsider. So then the redeemer of the blood, the brother of the victim, has the moral energy to go and kill the murderer to bring justice to this family. But if you're dealing with fratricide, murder against murder, so you kill the second brother, what justice do you bring to the family? Now you've lost two children. The moral dilemma of fratricide, the moral dilemma created by this particular scenario, is the very intensity, the very exacerbated intensity around the crime creates the kind of moral ambiguity around the justice required to execute the murder. So, for example, if we look at we're in this Perek Gimel. If we look at Perek Yudalet for a second. Very powerful story that appears at the beginning of the next perek. And we're going to get to this story in much more detail, but I just want to highlight one point here, which is starting with Pasuk Hey. There's a story, this Isha from Tekoa, there is a particular woman from Tekoa who meets David HaMelech and presents David with a scenario which will eventually lead David to have enough compassion for Avshalom to enable him to come home. But the dilemma that she presents is exactly the dilemma that David HaMelech is, or that should resonate in the world of David. Vayomer laMelech Malach v'tomer ha'ishal mana ani v'yamot ishi. I am a widow, and my husband has died. Ulishivchatcha shnei banim, and I only have two children. Vayinatzu shneihem basadeh, and they were fighting in the field. And there was no one to save them, no one to part them. And one rose up against the other and killed him. Kain Hevel. Now what? So Goel Adam. So the family, there's no other brother. So who's the next Yoresh? A nephew? A cousin, right, whoever's next in line for the Yerusha. The rest of the family has risen up against your maidservant. And said to me, give us the brother who killed his brother so that we can kill him. But in so doing, we will destroy your only heir. And if you destroy my last child, my only heir, my husband will have no namesake. Well, there will be no continuity in the family. These Goel Adam, these redeemers, they're these vultures who are looking to bring to kill my final my remaining child. They want the Yerusha. The moral complexity created in this particular case by exacerbates the or highlights the problem. And so David, in his compassion, he says to her, not to worry. No, but not, nobody will harm the second child. Goel Adam lo yashmidu et bini, right? Promise me that the Goel Adam will not be able to destroy my son. I will protect him with my life, says David. So at that point, she turns to him and says, okay, so then why don't you bring Avshalom home? How it connects to Avshalom, we'll see. But you understand that the dilemma is very real. The institution of the Goel Hadam fails the moment you deal with the exacerbate the intensity of not just a murder, but of a murder of a brother of fratricide. Because now I'm perpetuating the pain and the angst within the family by saying, okay, so the third brother's going to kill the second brother. And I just, that doesn't make any sense. So what do you do? So if the institution of the Goel Adam fails, what do you do with fratricide? What do you do with brother who kills brother? The Goel Adam can't kill the second brother because that leaves, just perpetuates the degradation of the destruction of the family.
The court could do it, but it would do the same thing in
correct.
The end.
The court could do it. It would do the same thing.
Another brother.
So what's the solution?
It could also maybe depend on if it was like an accident or if it was
accident, we're not talking about an accident. If it's an accident, we're talking then it goes to the Ir Miklat. Then we're not talking about that. We're talking about premeditated murder. Avshalom kills Amnon. Premeditated murder. That's the only case you have a Goel Adam. Otherwise, it's he's protected.
But also in this case, I mean, like, there was a... He was trying to do some justice where there wasn't any, so it wasn't exactly the same as just somebody saying, like,
We'll get to that. We'll get to that issue. Right now, I just want to understand the framework. Fratricide in general. Forget David for a second. We'll come back to it. Fratricide in general. What do? You can't assign the Goel Adam to kill the second brother. You just, right, from the perspective of justice, it doesn't help to kill the second brother because... I think of it from the perspective of the parents, right? One brother kills another, so you're going to take the second child. That doesn't make any sense. So what's the solution? What punishment can you assign to the murderer?
Well, they can flee.
Right. The only judgment you can assign to the murderer is exile. Because essentially what you're saying is, it doesn't help. You can't kill the second brother. On the other hand, what are you going to do? Gather the whole family together for a family gathering on Yontif? Can you imagine the conversation sitting around the table at a Thanksgiving dinner? Right. So what are you going to do with that second brother? So the Torah solution is the only logical solution, which is exile. You can't kill him, but you can exile him. So if you distance him, you disconnect. We have many examples in history and in our own society and in our own culture of people who commit certain acts that are so perceived as so negative and so bad within the context of the community that we ostracize or even worse. There was a time when somebody did something like marrying out. Families would sit shiva for them, right? There were circumstances in which a person I'm not comparing the two, but there are circumstances in which certain actions were considered such that the societal values said, okay, we can't do anything about it, but we can't bring and embrace such a person back into the family or back into the community. So exile was the only solution. What was God's answer to Cain? What was his punishment to Cain? Exile. What was Rivka's solution to Yaakov before Esav killed him? Exile. In fact, and here's an interesting observation. When Rivka says to Yaakov, you need to run away before Esav catches you, she uses a very powerful phrase. What does she say? She says... Here, let's go back to the page for a second. She says, I will call you back, right? Ad shuv af achicha mimcha, until his anger kind of dissipates. V'shechachat asher sitalo, and hopefully he'll one day forget what you did. And then I'll call you and I'll bring you back from this exile that we're sending you to. V'shalachti v'lekachticha misha. Because otherwise, lama eshkal gam shnechem yom echad. Why should I lose you both on one day? The Mefarshim are bothered by the assertion Because if Esav actually killed Yaakov, why would she lose both of them? She would only lose Yaakov. Says the Rashbam. What does he mean, both of them? In Yarogotcha, if Esav kills you, then gam hu yehareg al yedei goelei hadam. Then at some point or another, your redeemer of your blood will come and kill him, and so eventually I will lose you both. So Nechama Leibowitz, in her Sefer on Sefer Breshit, quotes this source. It's a 19th century Italian commentary known as Eliyahu ben Amozeg. I've never actually seen the Sefer. I've seen the Sefer on HebrewBooks.org, but fascinating insight. He writes there, says, no matter what happens, says Rivka to Yaakov, Eyesh gula yom echad, I will lose you both on one day. Why? Because if he kills you, haharug enenu, the victim is no longer. But somebody who kills their brother, he is so despised in my eyes, he would be as if he is a stranger and an enemy, and as if they are no longer exiled, distanced, because that's the punishment for fratricide. And therefore, in the end, I will lose you both in one day. One as the victim and one as the perpetrator, but I lose you both. If not physically, at least emotionally, in terms of a connection, I lose you both. And that is exactly the tragedy of David. And David is faced with this moment when one brother has killed another. How many children has David lost at that moment, besides from Bathsheba, just in that story? How many children has David lost? He's lost Amnon, and he's had to exile Avshalom. Now, it's true, he didn't actually have to exile Avshalom, because Avshalom did him the service of exiling himself, running away. So he spares David the pain of having to place Avshalom on trial. But at the end of the day, he's lost them both.
Can I say something?
Hmm.
Because, well, that's in a way David's fault because he didn't act in the beginning.
I don't disagree with the fact that the story should have or could have ended in a different direction. But that's less significant. I mean, that's important for us. But in the context of the flow of the story at this point, that's water under the bridge, right? That was 2 years ago. Right now we're dealing with, okay, Avshalom says, well, you're not, there's many consequences to that inaction, right? The whole rebellion that Avshalom launches in the next two prakim is also part of that consequence. But for now, David is looking out and he's essentially lost two children. So everybody sees that he's lost Amnon. What the text is going to do for us is it's going to bring us back into the world of a recognition that David has lost not one child, but two. Because that, from an emotional perspective, we don't see or hear that piece of the story. And that's what I think is happening. And this I found in an article by Elchanan Samet in one of the early editions of Megadim, but it's a very powerful observation that essentially all of this repetition of Vayivrach Avshalom, Avshalom Barach, Avshalom's flight highlights and in specific strategic locations, highlights the fact that David has lost not one child, but two. So now let's go back to the text. And we're going to work with the following assumption. The subject of this part of the story is essentially twofold. Number one, the murder of Amnon. Number two, the reaction, the impact it has on David and on David's life. Those are the two major themes. So when Avshalom runs away, he runs away immediately after having killed Amnon. But at that point in time, it's irrelevant information. It doesn't add anything to the story. The story is about Amnon. The story is about Avshalom who kills Amnon. And at that moment, the text is going to take us back into the palace and say, and place the focus of the story on David and the reaction within the palace walls. So let's go back to the text. Vayikra HaMelech, we're starting from Pasuk Lamed. Vayiema baderech v'ashmua ba'al David lemor hika Avshalom et kol b'nei HaMelech. At that point, Avshalom, David hears that Avshalom, the rumor is that Avshalom has killed the entire royal family. Lo natar mehem echad, not one is left. Yaakov, Melech, Vayikra Bagadav, Vayishkav Arza, Bechol Avadav, Nitzavim, Vayikra Bagadim, they're tearing their clothes, they're sitting on the floor, and Yonadav comes in to comfort the king. And he says to the king, no, don't think for a moment that all of the Bnei HaMelech have been killed. Only Amnon. Avshalom has been planning this for 2 years. Only Amnon has been lost. Only Amnon is dead. Don't think for a moment that all Bnei HaMelech have died. Only Amnon has died. Who is the tragedy about? Amnon. Amnon is the victim. Amnon deserves it. Amnon was no great loss. Amnon was the one who raped his sister. Amnon is the one who Avshalom took matters into his hands and killed. Amnon is the only one here who's dead. Everybody else is coming home. Vayivrach Avshalom. Fact number one. Avshalom ran away. Vayisa na'ar tzofer t'ayna vayar v'ine am rab ochi miderech acharav mitzad ahar. Suddenly the lookout sees and all of the Bnei HaMelech are coming home. Vayomer Yonadav, and Yonadav says to the king, you see, I was right. All Bnei HaMelech have returned. Was he right? Hine Bnei HaMelech Ba'o, the sons of the king have come back. Bnei HaMelech have returned. Was he right? Of course he was right. Bnei HaMelech have returned. What's the problem? Did all Bnei HaMelech come back?
Except for a couple.
Except for Amnon. Amnon is missing because Amnon levado met. Amnon alone is missing. Amnon alone has died. Says the text. Wait a second. You're looking through the eyes of Yonadav. You're looking through the eyes of the Tzofeh. No, you have to look through the eyes of David. In the eyes of David, I don't know how many children there were, but I'm going to throw out a number just to play a game with you. Okay? I'm going to assume there were 12 children. Okay? The Bnei HaMelech were 10 Bnei HaMelech and Amnon and Avshalom. Okay, humor me for a second. It'll kind of resonate with this week's parasha. 12 sons go out to the field. Avshalom kills Amnon. The other brothers flee. How many brothers flee? 10. Yonadav says, all the brothers are coming home. Only Amnon is dead. So who's coming home? How many?
11. 10.
10.
10.
Why 10?
Avshalom fled and
Amnon is dead. In other words, what the text is trying to tell me is, don't look at this from the eyes of Yonadav. Look at this from the eyes of David. Amnon levado met. Amnon alone has died. Yes, but Avshalom has fled. And therefore, David is missing two children that day. Bnei HaMelech have come home, but David is missing two children. Because Amnon levadom met, but vayivrach Avshalom. And now for the first time we're told that Avshalom is no longer here either. And so it's like Yaakov who says to his children when Yosef is gone and they want to take Binyamin down to Mitzrayim, and Yaakov says, I lost Yosef and now I'm going to lose, and now I'm going to lose Binyamin. Right? I've lost Amnon, now I'm going to lose Avshalom. Amnon levad omet, but vayivach Avshalom. So how many children came back? By Yavo ko b'nei ha-melech. Hinei b'nei ha-melech, the 10 remaining. But there were 12. So if David is left in a unique perspective that even Yonadav doesn't hear, and hence the Vayivach Avshalom is inserted here. Now, is it relevant to us where at this point, is it relevant to us where Avshalom went? No. Is it relevant to us to tell us how long he remains in exile? No. At this point in the story, the only piece that's relevant is the fact that that David is missing, that two children of David do not come home that day. Amnon and Avshalom. And then we move to the next part of the story. B'nei HaMelech come home, the 10 remaining children. And now, v'yisu kulam v'yivku, v'gam HaMelech v'chol avadav b'chu b'chi gadol ma'od, and they're crying, and they're tearing, and they're mourning. And who are they mourning for? So clearly, v'yitabel al b'no kol yamim. David is mourning for Amnon. It says, all the mafashim. This phrase, I haven't found a single parish that translates this phrase differently. Vayitabel al b'no kol yamim. He mourned for his son all the days. David ayam itabel al Amnon b'no. Mitzuru David. Vayitabel hamelech al Amnon b'no. Robag. Vayitabel hamelech al Amnon b'no. Ki met. But that verse starts with Avshalom barach. Vayelech al Tamai ben Amihud melech Geshur. Vayitabel al b'no kol yamim. So I've jumped from Avshalom's exile to David's mourning for Amnon all of his days. Now, there's an irony here. What's the irony? There's a notion, and there is a notion, I have to be careful how we phrase it, but there's a very important concept that the process of mourning for a loss of anybody, but in particular for a child, is painful, it's intense, but it's designed to enable a person to function moving forward. There are moments, however, and there's a kind of this notion of what Chazal referred to as the bracha of nishtakach min alev, the bracha of a person forgetting the intensity of the pain of loss. So we're left with memories, but the pain of loss, it's like the Havdil, a little bit like the pain of childbirth, right? You remember the pain, but the actual intensity of the pain is dissipates, and that's a bracha. So in Bereishit Lamed Zayin, we have the following story by Yaakov. Vayikra Yaakov simlotav, Yaakov tore his garments. This is after he's told that Yosef was, he's shown the coat of Yosef, and he says, Tarof Taraf Beniva, my son has been torn asunder. And so Vayitabel al b'no yamim rabim, he mourns for his son for many years. All of his children come to bring him comfort. And Yaakov is inconsolable. I will go down to the grave with this Eva, with this mourning. Now, in the context of the story, it's to highlight the intensity around which Yaakov's connection to Yosef is brought to bear. But Rashi makes a very powerful observation, which is that under no normal routine of circumstances, Ein Adam Yachol Lekabel Tanchumim Alachai.
When a person is mourning the loss of a child, as painful as it is, there is a certain bracha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has instilled in the human condition that enables a person to function by remembering the person and their life, but the intensity around the pain dissipates. That's assuming that they know that the child has died. Whereas if they think the child is alive still, they're inconsolable. Ein adam yachol lakavel tanchumim al hachai v'savur shemet. Because there's always that hope or that anticipation that maybe he's still alive. That's why there's such an intensity around the issue of people who are missing in action or in war or captured by enemy soldiers. Even if the logic dictates that they're no longer alive, but the fact that we don't have a body, the fact that we don't have a mace, the fact that there's no resolution to the question just adds an intensity around the mourning process. So in that context, Vayitabel Abno Kol Hayamim, if we're talking about Amnon, the question is why is he mourning for all these years, David? In fact, Yibabinel asks this question. For the child of Bathsheba, David was willing to be consoled. Right? For the child of Bathsheba, he got up from mourning right away and he said, the child's not coming back to me. I will eventually go to him. But for Amnon, he's mourning for his whole life. Yamim Rabim.
So, well, he's not, because it says right in the next pasuk that he was comforted about Amnon. So
right,
maybe he's right. Just mourning because of Absalom.
So what does it mean by Itabel Abinasol? So Tafka, the Arma Farshi would say that the Yamim Rabim referred to in this pasuk is only the 3 years referred to in the next pasuk. In other words, when it says that he mourned for his son, Kol Yamim, it really means the same 3 years that until he was brought comfort. But I'm going to suggest something else. That the subject of the mourning in Pasuk Lamed Zayin is not Amnon.
It's Avshalom.
It's Avshalom. And that's the link to the first half of the Pasuk. Avshalom didn't just run away. He ran away to Tamai ben Amihud Melech Geshur. He ran away to a foreign country. He's alive. He's alive. He's there. And at some point or another, as a parent, it's one thing to lose one child. Now he's lost the second child. And that child is sitting out in a foreign country embraced by his grandfather, who is the king of a foreign nation, Melech Geshur. And at some point or another, David feels the angst, not just for Amnon, but for Avshalom. And it may not be logical, it may not be rational. Avshalom, at the end of the day, is the one who killed Amnon, but this is, we're talking about a father. And we're talking about a father who knows that his son is alive. So it's not even a suffix, not even a question. He knows his son is alive. He knows where he is. He knows he's in Melech Geshur. He knows in Eretz Geshur. He knows he's by his grandfather. And he knows that he's there. And he feels that pain. And he can't be consoled. By Itabel Abno Kol Yamin. And therefore, finally, after 3 years, Vahisham Shaloshanim, David has a dramatic change of heart. And Vatichal David HaMelech Latzet Alev Shalom, his soul, his nefesh, begins to long for, begins to pine for Avshalom, even though Avshalom committed fratricide, even though Avshalom killed the crown prince, even though Avshalom committed treason. But Avshalom is his son. And so, Vatichal David HaMelech Latzet El Avshalom, he begins to pine for Avshalom. Why? Nicham al Amnon Kimet. He recognizes that Amnon is dead, and he's not going to bring back Amnon. And he's going to apply to Amnon the same principle that he applied to the child of Bathsheba. I will go to him, he will not come back to me. But Avshalom is alive. And at some point or another, his heart overpowers his head. He knows in his head that bringing back Avshalom is not the right move. He knows in his head that Avshalom is treasonous, that Avshalom wants to kill him and take over the kingdom. But he's a father. And so he yearns for Avshalom, despite the fact that Avshalom is sitting in exile, because he's alive, because he's in exile. And so what I am suggesting in our text is that the references to Avshalom's flight helps us understand the emotional transformation that's taking place in David HaMelech. I'm going to stop sharing for a second. Helps us understand the emotional transformation that's taking place in David HaMelech. To recognize that he sent all the sons out into the field, and Yonadav says only one is killed, and David says two have not come home today. There are two chairs missing around the table. Vayivach Avshalom, and the rest of the Bnei HaMelech came home. And then he realizes that literally as he's mourning for Amnon, that Avshalom is alive and well, and being embraced by his grandfather from his mother's side, king of Geshur. And so he begins to feel the fact that he can't be comforted. He can't be comforted, he can't be consoled, because Avshalom is not dead, he's alive. Until finally, the final stage of this text, which is that after 3 years, his heart begins to conquer his head, and he says, I want him back. Whether it's a mistake or not, to be seen. But that's where David's head is at, and that's exactly why the next perek begins, right? After this statement, Ki necham al Amnon kimet v'tachal David letzet al Avshalom, what's the next perek? V'yeda Yoav ben Tzruah ki lev ha-melech al Avshalom. All of Perek Yudalid is the machinations that everybody goes through to convince David that it's okay to bring Avshalom back. So the table is now set for Avshalom's return, which will lead to Avshalom's rebellion, which will lead to all kinds of tragedies in the household. I mean, the story only gets more intense from here, but the transformation in David is critical for us to see, and that's how this kind of this very brief text that's divided up into three different phrases in three different places kind of helps us navigate through the emotion and the emotional change that takes place in David's world. That's it. Questions? I know it's a hard subject. These subjects are so hard, and they're very close to home. So I am, I appreciate the fact that it's a difficult series of stories to really kind of process. But I think that it's critically important for us to see it and to deal with it as openly and as we can. So thank you for listening, and thank you for your time.
You taught this story so well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
You really make us feel it.
Yeah.
We will take a 2-week break to kind of process all that together. And